Chapter 7, Eden, like no place on earth. God does not act without purpose. He created the heavenly host, intending that they carry out his will. Did he create them to meet some need in him? No. A complete, perfect being has no deficiencies. God has no need of a council, but he uses one. Similarly, God did not need humans to steward his creation, or later on, to reveal that Messiah had come. But those were his choices as well. God delighted in creating proxies to represent him and carry out his wishes. His decisions in that regard have ramifications. Earth was not Eden. The first observation is one that is transparent from the biblical text, but somehow missed by many. Not all the world was Eden. It's important to establish that Eden was, rather than the entire earthly creation, only a tiny part of it. This distinction will become important in future chapters. The text tells us this in several ways. Eden was actually a tiny plot on earth. Its location is circumscribed by geographical markers. Genesis 2:8-14. In the last chapter, we saw the Ugaritic council meet in a garden where two rivers intersected, in the midst of the fountains of the double deep. Eden is described with four water sources. This description alone tells us quite clearly that the earth was not Eden. There are other indications. In Genesis 1:26-27, God made humankind as his imagers, his representatives in this new domain. This functional view of the image becomes clearer in the commands of verse 28. And God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth, and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of heaven, and over every animal that moves upon the earth." Notice that verse 28 says, "The earth needed filling." This does not refer to Eden. Eden has not even appeared yet in the Genesis story. Its first mention comes in Genesis 2:8. And Yahweh God planted a garden in Eden in the east, and there he put the man whom he had formed. The Garden of Eden is said to be in the east. The directional word informs us that there were other parts of the earth. God planted his garden. We know from Genesis 1 that the dry land, called earth, already existed. It had to, in order for God to plant a garden in it to the east. Genesis 2:15 is also of interest. The man God has made is put in the garden for a reason. And Yahweh took the man and set him in the Garden of Eden to cultivate it and to keep it. The man's job is to take care of the garden. Earlier in Genesis 1:28, his job was to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule. Of course, the man needs a woman for that, but she hasn't even been created yet in Genesis 2 when God puts the man in the garden. Cultivation of the garden and subduing the earth are not the same task. Genesis 1 and 2 aren't intended to be chronological in their relationship. What they reveal is that man's original task was to care for the garden where he lived after he gets a partner in Genesis 1. God says to both of them, the commands are plural in Hebrew, to be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, and rule over its creatures. We can see that the task of humanity, taken in tandem with the earlier observations that require Eden and earth to be distinct, distinguish Eden and the earth. It makes no sense to subdue the garden of God. It's already what God wants it to be. There's no place on earth like it. If it needed subjugation, that would imply imperfection. That's something that cannot be said about Eden, but it's true about the rest of the world. For sure, God was happy with the whole creation. He pronounced it very good, Genesis 1:31, but very good is not perfect. Lastly, Eden and earth must be distinct since after the fall, Adam and Eve are expelled from it and have to live elsewhere. Unless you believe that they were sent into outer space, you must acknowledge Eden and Earth as distinct. Observing this distinction affects a range of biblical concepts and provides solutions to a few thorny theological problems. But I'm only concerned with one issue here. The distinction helps us to see that the original task of humanity was to make the entire Earth like Eden. Adam and Eve lived in the garden. They cared for it, but the rest of the earth needed subduing. It wasn't awful. In fact, Genesis 1 tells us that it was habitable. But it wasn't quite what Eden was. The whole world needs to be like God's home. He could do the job himself, but he chose to create human imagers to do it for him. He issued the decree. They were supposed to make it happen. They were to do that by multiplying and following God's direction. Eden is where the idea of the kingdom of God begins, and it's no coincidence that the Bible ends with a vision of a new Edenic earth, Revelation 21:22. Proclamation and partnership. In the working relationship between God and humankind, before and after the fall, involves genuine, meaningful participation on the part of God's human imagers. This is most transparently seen as God works through figures like Moses, Joshua, David, Solomon, the prophets, and the apostles. But the pattern extends to us, to all believers. There's nothing we do that God could not accomplish himself. But he has not chosen that method. Rather, he tells us what his will is and commands his loyal children to get the job done. We saw in an earlier chapter that imaging status is something shared by human and non-human divine beings. This fact is reflected in the plural language of Genesis 1:26 when God said, "Let us make humankind." The ensuing singular forms guided us to conclude that the passage was humankind created by a single creator, the God of Israel, who creates humans as his imagers. The prior plural language was a clue that God's other family, the divine sons of God, created sometime earlier, were also imagers of their creator. Given this connection and backdrop, the participatory nature of the working relationship between God and his human imagers is no surprise. The heavenly council works under the same kind of arrangement. God decrees his will and leaves it to his administrative household to carry out those decrees. That's apparent from two Old Testament passages. First, Kings 22 provides a revealing glimpse into a divine council meeting. The first 15 verses set the context. After 3 years of peace between Syria and Israel, King Jehoshaphat of Judah, the southern Israelite kingdom, paid a visit to Ahab, the king of Israel. The northern kingdom had broken away from the tribes loyal to David's dynasty. The northern kings were described throughout the Old Testament as spiritually apostate. Ahab was arguably the worst of the bunch. Ahab wanted Jehoshaphat to join forces with him in a plan to break the peace by attacking Ramoth-Gilead, which was under Syrian control. Ramoth-Gilead was part of the original tribal land of Gad and a Levitical city of refuge. Joshua 28, 21, 38, 1 Chronicles 6, 80, Deuteronomy 4, 43. It didn't legitimately belong to the Syrians. That was Ahab's leverage. Jehoshaphat agreed with this reasoning, but wanted to know whether Yahweh approved. The apostate king of Israel summoned about 400 of his prophets, who told the king they would win the battle. Suspicious, Jehoshaphat asked if there were any other prophets around to consult. "Yes, there is one," Ahab answered, and made no secret of his hatred of that prophet. Micaiah, the prophet of Yahweh, always told Ahab things he didn't want to hear, like the truth. Micaiah was summoned and asked whether the king should go to war. At first he mocked Ahab, pretending to be like the other prophets, but Ahab wasn't stupid. Here's what happened next. Then the king, Ahab, said to him, "How many times must I make you swear that you shall not tell me anything but truth in the name of Yahweh?" So he, Micaiah, said, "I saw all of Israel scattering to the mountains like sheep without a shepherd." Yahweh also said, "There are no masters for these. Let them return in peace, each to his house." Then the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, Did I not say to you that he would not prophesy good concerning me, but disaster?" And he, Micaiah, said, "Therefore hear the words of Yahweh. I saw Yahweh sitting on his throne with all the host of heaven standing beside him from his right hand and from his left hand. And Yahweh said, 'Who will entice Ahab so that he will go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead?'" Then this one was saying one thing, and the other was saying another. Then a spirit came out and stood before Yahweh and said, "I will entice him." Said Yahweh to him, "How?" And said, "I will go out, and I will be a false spirit in the mouth of all his prophets." And he said, "You shall entice and succeed. Go out and do so." So then, see that Yahweh has placed a false spirit in the mouth of all these your prophets, and Yahweh has spoken disaster concerning you. 1 Kings 22:16-23. This passage, specifically verses 19-22, describes a meeting between God and his divine counsel. Verse 20 tells us plainly that God has decided it was time for Ahab to die. God then asks the host of heaven, standing in attendance, how Ahab's death should be accomplished. God had decreed Ahab was going to die at Ramoth-Gilead, but the means of his death was not decreed. The council debated the matter until one of the spiritual beings came forward with a proposition, vis-a-vis 21 and 22. "I will go out, and I will be a false spirit in the mouth of all his prophets." Upon hearing this, God said, paraphrasing, "Good, I know that'll work. Go get it done." There are other glimpses of this kind of divine decision-making where God's decree and genuine participation on the part of his counselor are both evident. In Daniel 4, Nebuchadnezzar relates a dream wherein he saw an enormous tree that reached into the heavens. Nebuchadnezzar tells Daniel that in this dream he saw a watcher, a term for a divine being, a holy one. In this chapter of Daniel, Daniel 14, verses 13, 17, and 23, the watcher proclaims that the tree will be chopped down, leaving only its stump. The tree and the stump are symbols for Nebuchadnezzar, who the watcher announces will lose his mind and become like an animal. Daniel 4, 13 through 16. In verse 17, readers discover who decreed this fate for Nebuchadnezzar. The sentence is by the decree of the watchers, and the decision by the command of the holy ones, in order that the living will know that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdom of humankind, and to whomever he wills, he gives it. Daniel 4:17. What's fascinating here is that the source of the decree is said to be the watcher, is said to be the watchers, but sovereignty belongs to the singular Most High. Later, when Daniel interprets the dream, he says, this is the explanation, O king, "It is a decree of the Most High that has come upon my lord the king." Daniel 4:24. Here we see that the ultimate authority behind the decree is God, the Most High. And yet the watcher who delivered the decree in verse 17 said, the sentence is by decree of the watchers. Both God and his divine agents were involved in the decision. Daniel adds a few details as he continues. Note the emphasis in bold carefully. "You, Nebuchadnezzar, will be driven away from human society, and you will dwell with the animals of the field. And you will be caused to graze grass like the oxen yourself, and you will be watered with the dew of heaven. And 7 periods of time will pass over you until that you have acknowledged that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdom of humankind, and to whom he wills, he gives it. And in that, they said to leave alone the stump of the tree's root, so your kingdom will be restored for you when you acknowledge that heaven is sovereign. Daniel 4:25-26. Verse 25 says very plainly that the Most High is sovereign. It is clearly singular. The phrase heaven is sovereign is interesting because the Aramaic word translated heaven, Shemayin, is plural and is accompanied by a plural verb. The plurality of Shemayin can point to either the members of the council or the council as a collective. In any event, the wording is suggestive of the interchange between council and Most High earlier in Daniel 4. The takeaway is that God rules over the heavenly realm and the earthly realm with the genuine assistance of his imager representatives. He decrees, and they carry out his commands. These points are clear. What is perhaps less clear is that the way God's will is carried out and accomplished is open. Imagers can make free decisions to accomplish God's will. God decrees the ends, but the means can, and apparently are at times, left up to the imagers. This balance of sovereignty and free will is essential for understanding what happened in Eden. The choices made by human and non-human beings described in Genesis 3 were neither coerced nor needed by Yahweh for sake of his greater plan. The risk of creating image bearers who might freely choose rebellion was something God foresaw but did not decree. We'll examine all that in more detail in the next chapter.